Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How long does it take to accurately size a person up, and how can we know which hunches are most likely to yield accurate conclusions? Most of us imagine we are in control of what and how much we reveal about ourselves to the people around us. But as my guest today will explain, research suggests there are plenty of giveaways as to our inner lives and even our futures to be found in even brief encounters with other people, provided they know what to look for. Matthew Hertenstein is Associate Professor of Psychology at DePaul University. His new book is The Tell, The Little Clues That Reveal Big Truths About Who We Are. Matt, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So regardless of what we say, I guess our bodies convey a lot of information about us and can even offer clues as to what might happen decades from now.
Yeah, so there's been a large body of evidence that's been accumulating showing that these little clues that we think are, you know, instantaneous and, you know, happen in just the moments of time that we interact with people, they do and have the potential to predict certain things about us later on in life, and more evidence is accumulating as such.
And our tendency to read other people's movements and their faces and what they do, I mean, that sort of makes sense because we've been hanging out with other humans since before we would have had much language to communicate with them.
Yeah, exactly. So in some cases, you're exactly right. I mean, our brains have been molded over, you know, thousands of years to be very keenly aware of some of these things. And in many cases, we're very good at making these predictions based on these nonverbal cues, facial expressions, vocal inflection, and so on. But in other cases, and I'm sure we'll get into this throughout the hour, scientists have actually had to point out things to us that we might not really know, but through some of their studies, they've been able to figure out some connections between our nonverbal cues that we give off and sort of things that it predicts later on in life.
We should make clear here at the outset that you are not advocating that we only use these tells in order to judge other people. Will you give us some perspective on how to use the things you'll be explaining without mistaking, cause and effect for a corollary relationship?
Yeah, so most of the studies that I talk about in my book, The Tell, are correlational, which, you know, basically tells you that one variable predicts another variable. So we'll talk about, for example, I'm sure, how smiling predicts something about our relationships that we have down the road in our lives. And we know that, you know, in this case, smiling predicts something about, you know, our relationship status later in life, but I don't want to make any claim that smiling causes this or whatnot, because only a true experiment in science can really differentiate between cause and effect, or has a chance to. And most of the studies that I'm talking about, it's correlational, which means you can predict that X causes Y, but you can't say that X, you can predict that X predicts Y, but you can't say it causes Y.
Well, let's talk about smiling. We all learn from about the age of 3 when somebody says, smile for the camera, we learn to sort of make our mouths fake a smile. But there's a difference between a natural smile and one that we put on to look happy.
Yeah, so there's this really fascinating work being done showing that basically we have two different types of smiles, broadly speaking. One, smile is sort of the forced smile that most of us can put on voluntarily, you know, the one that pulls up our lip corners, and it's easy to do in a picture, or you see this when you're on an airplane and the flight attendant smiles at you and asks you what you'd like or something. And that, you know, is, like I said, easy to do voluntarily. But there's another smile that researchers call the Duchenne smile. And in that smile, you're not only contracting the corner, the muscle that pulls up the corners of your lips, but you're contracting that muscle around your eyes, you know, the one that gives you kind of that twinkle in your eyes. And that smile is very difficult to do voluntarily. Only about 10% of people can do it, like, on demand.
Hmm.
So when you see that smile, you see that muscle around the eyes contracted like that, it usually means that it's more of a genuine, sincere smile, not one that's being put on for the the person you're talking to is amusement, so to speak.
So that is something we can look for in trying to judge how happy a person really is to see us.
Yeah, exactly. Next time you tell a joke to one of your friends, If you see that smile, that probably means that they genuinely found your joke funny. But if you don't see that muscle contracted around their eyes, it probably tells you that they're smiling for your benefit.
Go back and work on the punchline a little bit.
Right, exactly.
Well, what about smiling in yearbook pictures? I thought this was really fascinating. Somebody did a study and went back and looked at old pictures of people in school and then asked about their lives today.
Yeah, so that study was actually conducted in my lab. And what we did, we did a couple different studies. In one study, we looked at yearbook photos from the college years, and we looked at those two muscles I described before, the muscle that pulls up your lip corners and the ones around your eyes, and we coded each picture on a scale. And so it was approximately about from 1 to 10. And so each picture got a scale and just on how intensely those muscles were contracted. And then we asked a question, and the question was pretty simple. Is of those people who had gotten married at some point in their lives, were they still married or had they gotten a divorce? And from those yearbook photos, we found that those who smiled least in those photos, you know, the sort of the stoic-looking folks, they were about 5 times more likely to get a divorce at some point in their lives compared to those who smiled the most. And so we were, you know, I step back from that finding, and on one hand, I think it's pretty amazing, right? You know, it's just one snapshot in time when you're, you know, 18 to 22 years old approximately, for at least the people that we looked at. And that can predict something years down the road. And so that's a pretty neat finding. And then we wanted to see, well, does this relate to anything about childhood photos that were taken earlier, you know, photos of, you know, you blowing out the candles of your birthday cake or opening up a present during the holidays or something like that. So we actually looked at other people in the town in which my university is, and we found that pictures were taken on average when the people were 10 years old. And those pictures, too, also predicted whether or not a person was divorced or not. So smiling in our photos does seem to predict something about, you know, our marital stability later on in life. Of course, not for every single person, mm-hmm. and there's always variability and all that sort of thing. But it's definitely a trend that's there.
So, Matt, what do you think is at work there? Could it be that people who don't really want to smile for a yearbook photo are also people who, you know, don't want to make concessions within a relationship? Could it be something like that?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. That goes back to one of your first questions that you asked about, you know, what causes it versus what predicts it. And that study is a great example of, you know, from the data, we don't know for sure what causes that. But my sort of looking at the literature, looking at some other findings, my suspicion is that it has something to do with people who smile on average, and I use average, I really want people to key into that because, you know, there's always people who are having a bad day or, you know, don't like their teeth and they don't want to show them in a picture or whatever. But people on average in their photos who smile tend to be happier. We know that from other studies. It could be that, you know, those people are more optimistic and they attract people who are more optimistic, and those types of people might have more successful marriages. But, you know, it could be any number of other factors. One of my favorites is that maybe people who smile in response to the photographer telling them to do so are actually more obedient. And perhaps obedience facilitates marital stability. I don't know.
We could spend a whole hour talking about obedience and marriage, so we'll move on from that
exactly. Specifically.
But it stands to reason that our tells would begin early in life. Can you talk about some of the interesting discoveries that scientists have made about early childhood indicators of normal or atypical development that are not related necessarily to the use of language?
Sure. Actually gets into one of the reasons that I wrote the book. And I'll tell it sort of from a personal perspective, but then I'll kind of tell you what the science says, too. You know, about 7 or 8 years ago, I had my first son, and it was born. And, you know, I'm an expert in infant development. And so I'm pretty tuned into, you know, his emotional communication and cognitive developments and all this sort of stuff. And I noticed just some red flags, things that weren't quite right with his development. He wasn't smiling on a normal time scale. He wasn't babbling like a lot of other babies. He was kind of moving in a little bit different ways. His crawling was delayed, all these sorts of things. And it really, knowing some of the literature already, it drove me even more to read the literature and understand it. And what I was seeing, basically, and what scientists have been discovering over the last 5 to 10 years, is that there are some tells, some signs early in life that can predict whether a child has autism or not, or at least will develop autism.
Hmm.
And so I was obviously, like any parent would be, pretty alarmed by this. And there's literature that's coming out, which is really wonderful, that scientists are doing this. Is the literature is showing that there are some behavioral therapies out there that people can engage in, that you can basically, it's suggesting that you can kind of change the direction of the development. So the brain is so plastic early in life, it can be rewired. The earlier the better, sort of thing. And so we really tried to administer a lot of these empirically, scientifically based therapies with my son, and to try to help kind of rewire the trajectory of his brain. And sure enough, today he has no such signs of it. Now, I don't want to make the claim that, you know, every parent can, you know, change his or her son's or daughter's brains or whatnot. And I don't want to claim for sure that this is what happened with my son for sure, because it's only a case study and I don't want to make any big grand conclusions. But the point is that these early tells scientists are finding can predict the onset of autism, and there are these wonderful therapies that people can engage in that are effective for many of these children, but not all, of course.
Well, and it's wonderful that you had a good outcome for your son. But, of course, a lot of professional clinicians are hesitant to diagnose autism until much later than infancy.
Yeah, and they are hesitant, but I think that that trend is reversing a little bit, because people realize that the earlier you get kids treatment, the better. And the way, and I'm going to talk for a second as a father and less a scientist, but even so as a scientist, my figure or my thought was, you know, why not try to provide this therapy as much as I can, because there's absolutely no harm in doing so, right? It can only help. It can't hurt. And so that was my thinking on it. But, yeah, I think it's ultimately a decision by the parents and the physicians and whatnot, but we do know the science does suggest that the earlier you do begin therapy with children with autism, the better, more likely, I should say, that the success will be evident for that child.
So how much role do parents and the environment they provide play in shaping and refining the temperament of infants and children, and what kinds of temperamental indicators are there early in life that might predict how we do later?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, four-month-olds can be taken into a lab, and there's a researcher named Jerry Kagan who does this or has done this at Harvard University, and he and his group have taken four-month-olds into his lab, and they kind of perform a battery of tests on the baby, you know, opening bottles of foul-smelling chemicals in front of their nose to see if the baby reacts or how the baby reacts. Moving a mobile or some other object in front of the baby's face and shaking it and seeing how they react. And it turns out that a minority, maybe around 1 out of 5 kids or so, really get upset and when this happens and cry and arch their back and clench their fists and whatnot. And while some others kind of are cool cucumbers, you know, just take it in stride. And so they call this temperament, and in some degrees kind of this early predispositions of how to react, you know, in the world. And it turns out that these same kids who really get distraught and upset as four-month-olds tend to be significantly more likely to be shy and reticent throughout their childhood.
Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break. My guest is Matthew Hertenstein, Associate Professor of Psychology at DePaul University and author of The Tell, The Little Clues That Reveal Big Truths About Who We Are.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Associate Professor of Psychology Matthew Hertenstein. He teaches at DePaul University. His new book is called The Tell, The Little Clues That Reveal Big Truths About Who We Are. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. And Matt, before the break, you were telling us that these behaviors and responses noted in just a few minutes at 4 months of age can really predict a lot about how we'll respond to things later in life.
Yeah, so these at four months old, you can make these predictions based on just, you know, one visit to a laboratory, so to speak, of a psychologist, and these researchers can predict, the degree to which whether a person will be shy. It even predicts to some degree whether a person will have an anxiety disorder later on in late adolescence, early adulthood. And there's actually one study that came out a few years ago showing that you put kids who are tested early in life in terms of their how shy they were and whatnot, you put them in an fMRI magnet in early adulthood, and it turns out that their amygdala in their brain is actually overly responsive compared to some stimuli compared to kids who were not that way in early life. So even their brain functioning is tweaked a little bit differently. And I don't want to say that these people are abnormal, or it's pathological or whatever, but it's interesting that you can predict some of these behavioral inhibitions and tendencies early in life, so to speak, just by the profile that they show at 4 months.
So I found parts of the book that discuss appearance both fascinating and ultimately a little bit disturbing. Can you tell us about the research into face shapes of young men and what they suggested about particular tendencies?
Yeah, there's a lot of research on this, and I could talk about different parts of it, but I'll talk about a couple of specific ones. I mean, one is that you can tell something about men specifically in terms of their width, the ratio of their width to their face to the height of their face. And men who have wider faces, compared to the long type face, are actually perceived by people, number one, to be more aggressive. So, if we were all to look at people and rate them on how aggressive they look, we would tend to agree that wider faced men, holding other things constant, are perceived to be more aggressive. But not only are they perceived to be more aggressive, but they actually, there's evidence indirectly that they are more aggressive. So when you bring them into the lab and you test, how they behave towards other people or how much they exploit or cheat or whatever, they tend to be more aggressive and lie and cheat. So for example, there's one study that's really interesting where they had subjects roll a die and to see to be entered into a contest to win a $50 gift card from Walmart, I guess. Mm-hmm. And so they rolled the die, and then they were to report the number that they rolled. And unbeknownst to them, they didn't know that the researchers actually could see the actual true roll of the dice. And so then they reported that, and then, of course, the researchers could see, well, are they lying or are they telling the truth? And the widest-faced men were actually 9 times more likely to overstate their results compared to the sort of thinnest-faced men. So there's just one interesting example. And, of course, this is just takes place in a lab. But nonetheless, the fact that the ratio of width to height actually predicts anything about whether somebody's going to lie or cheats, pretty amazing. So aggressiveness is definitely one area. But another, and you said disturbing area, which I agree with you, and I say this in the book, is what researchers have actually done a couple studies that where they looked at, Caucasians and African Americans in Florida who were convicted of a felony. And then they had people look at just the faces of those people of those convicts who were convicted of that felony, and they had people rate them on quote-unquote Afrocentric features, and that's what the researchers called them. And so these were things like a broad nose or full lips or dark skin. And again, this is how the researchers defined it. And so people looked at their photos, and lo and behold, the people with the more Afrocentric features were significantly more likely to receive longer sentences. And it wasn't just a race issue, because even within race, that was true. So whites who had more Afrocentric features were sentenced to longer sentences compared to those with less perceived Afrocentric features. And the same thing with the African Americans. So it wasn't a race issue. It was actually within race. The Afrocentric features pulled for longer sentences. So that's one study. And then the other one, which is even, I think, more disturbing, is they looked at African Americans who were convicted of murder in Philadelphia. And again, they had them had their photos looked at by other people and for perceived Afrocentric features. And those people with the most Afrocentric features were put to death at a rate of 58%, versus those with the least Afrocentric features were put to death at a rate of 24%. So 58 versus 24%. And again, this is all within African Americans. But only they found the difference in Afrocentric features pulling for the death penalty differentially only as a function of if the person who was murdered was white. So that's a really disturbing finding too. So yeah, our faces do give off these things, and sometimes they can, our signals can go awry, I think.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Thomas in Dallas. Hey, Thomas.
Hi. Yeah, I've been called a reverse barometer, but people that are real nice and friendly, I mean, it seems like they're usually selling something or they're gossips. And I usually like the gruff types more and find they're more engaging and interesting. But anyway, it seems like that sort of, that's my instinct, so that kind of maybe puts a wrinkle in the plan. But I sympathize with much of what you're saying as well.
Well, that's really interesting. What do you think about all that, Matt?
I'm sorry, I had a little trouble hearing his question. Could you repeat that question for me, Chris?
Thomas was saying that, you know, when he sees somebody that comes up to him that is smiling and really friendly, he tends to assume they're selling something or they're a gossip, and he would rather be around people who are sort of gruff and taciturn.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, it's a fair point, and I think one of the things I talk about in the book is to always keep in mind the context. So I completely agree with the caller. I mean, you got to keep in mind context and whether they're a high likelihood for it to be a salesperson around you or not. You know, if you're just meeting somebody at a company party and they have no necessarily reason to sell you something, but just anything other than to socialize, then you might be making a very different judgment of their tells, of their nonverbal cues, compared to if you met them in a very different context where it's a high likelihood that somebody would sell. So I definitely see what the caller is saying, and I think you got to take context into account at all times.
What can you tell very quickly about somebody's ability to sell a product well or teach a class and keep everybody's attention?
Yeah, so there's some great research showing, and as a college professor, this really interests me, where researchers have shown about 6 seconds of a professor teaching a class, the first day of class, and they'll show a video of 6 seconds to people who have never taken a class, never seen the professor, and the sound is even turned off on the video. And they'll show those 6 seconds, and it turns out that judgments made on those 6 seconds can actually predict the end of the semester evaluations that students have of that professor, of the quality of the professor. So the quality of the professor can be ascertained in 6 seconds by silent video. And so that has all kinds of implications at the college level, but I think as well for the education K-12, because teachers are always being assessed by people with these short little clips, so to speak, by somebody sitting in your class for a half hour making a judgment of you. So that's one. And then looking at salespeople, yeah, the salespeople, the degree of success of a salesperson can be predicted just by short clips that people assess. And so that's pretty good knowledge for a person who's in business and wants to have a sales force that's successful. that you can make these predictions on how good they'll be just on a few minutes. I think that accords with some of our anecdotal evidence as well.
And in the case of the professors, it's about enthusiasm. That seems to be what tips the balance between the ones who get a good evaluation and the ones who don't. Is that right?
Yeah. So enthusiasm is largely it. And a fascinating study done at Cornell University a number of years ago where a researcher taught a course that he'd been teaching for like 20 years, taught a course in the fall, and then took a seminar on how to present in a really excited, enthusiastic manner, taught the exact same class, said the exact same things, used the exact same textbook in the spring, but just taught it in a different way in terms of his enthusiasm. And lo and behold, he got much higher evaluations of his own teaching, and students found the research more interesting, and surprisingly, they even found the textbook to be of higher quality, which is, of course, so there's like this enthusiasm halo that's over us. It kind of makes everything better around us.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Hope in Dallas. Hi, Hope.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, I just wanted to ask you a question. I'm listening to what you're saying with great interest, but I'm hearing a couple of assumptions I want to get some clarification on. In the faith study you were talking about and in the Afrocentric study you were talking about, I heard you saying, or I thought I heard you say, that a lot of the analysis you had done was on men. And I think we've seen in reports before some assumptions and studies have been made on men applied to women and have not actually been that accurate. So I kind of wanted to get your thoughts on that and, you know, hear your reply.
Yeah, thanks for asking. Yeah, the specific studies that I was talking about on convicted felons and convicted murderers were on men, exactly. And so I can't really speak to whether they generalize to women or the degree to which they do or don't, just because I don't have the data to say. And same thing for the aggression findings in terms of the width to height ratio. Although it's a little different in the sense that we know that about men. I mean, that's a consistent finding in the literature, but they do not find that for women. So I guess in that area I can say that it doesn't hold for women. But for the, again, the difference on the felon studies that I talked about, we just don't have the data either way, I just say.
What does it take for us to be aware of these potential biases and not unfairly judge people before they've given us a reason not to trust them?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I talk about in the book, I talk about predictive humility. I sort of end the book that way. And I do. I think that we have to be, I think it's important to be cognizant and mindful that we do have these predictive capacities sometimes. But at the same time, we have to exercise humility and not necessarily assuming that we're going to be correct all the time at an individual level. So when you look over several instances, it's true, we're probably going to be pretty accurate, at least in some areas. But at the individual level, the individual interaction, we have to be careful because we could always be wrong, of course. And our minds have what I think is kind of a bad habit in some ways, where if we think one thing, we actually look for evidence to confirm our initial suspicions. And we ignore evidence that you know, defies our suspicions and our hypotheses about things. So I think we have to be careful at every turn that we don't just automatically look for evidence that only confirms our suspicions, because we're not going to be more perceptive perceivers, but in fact we could actually get worse.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Galen in Plano. Hi, Galen.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well, thank you.
You actually just touched on what I was going to ask about, which was how can you tell if the person who's viewing the tale is actually reading more into it. You know, they have a bias or something that kind of comes out in their read.
Yeah, and I think that's a good question. I think we'll all have, to some degree, some biases and stuff, but I guess it goes back to what I was saying is showing that predictive humility, making sure that the evidence fits. For example, I talk about deception in the book and how to tell when somebody's lying. You might have a preconceived notion of whether somebody has a high or low likelihood of lying, so that might be your bias, so to speak. And maybe you do see some tells that suggest that the person's lying. And, you know, in the book, The Tell, that I wrote, I talk about some of those. And I'd say, you know, definitely you wouldn't want to go by one sign for sure. You'd want to go look at several different tells to help you ascertain whether or not the person is being truthful or deceitful. But even after that, it might not tell you whether their person's lying definitively, but it might be an opportunity for you to ask more questions if you do see those signs. So I think practicing the humility and asking some more follow-up questions is always important.
Well, let's talk about deception. The old thing about you can't possibly look someone straight in the eye and tell a lie, I mean, anyone who's ever been a teenager knows that's not really true.
Right. Yeah, and if you ask most people, and researchers have done this all around the world, the number one sign that people think tells somebody if they're lying or not is whether they avert their gaze. You know, they look away when they're talking to you. And it turns out that there is no link between that behavior and whether somebody or not is lying. So, you know, sometimes it's our knowledge or lack thereof that makes us such bad perceivers of lies. And we are, in fact, we're not that good at perceiving lies. We're barely above chance, if that. Most people might as well flip a quarter or a dime to help them decide whether somebody's lying or not, which is pretty humbling because sometimes people think that they are very good at telling lies, you know, but that confidence doesn't map onto reality. So there are several signs that people can look for in deception, and just a couple of them I'll touch on them. One is something called a micro expression, and Paul Ekman at the University of California, San Francisco, did a lot of this pioneering work where he found that these people show these really brief facial expressions, sometimes about 1/20th of a second when they tell a lie. And, you know, these brief facial expressions of contempt or anger or fear or something like that may reveal are more likely to happen when people lie. So that's one, and there are other ones. You know, facial expressions are almost always symmetrical when people are genuine. But if you see a lopsided facial expression, for example, that also tells a lie. So I talk about 8 or 9 different signs in the book that help people detect when somebody's lying or telling the truth.
But to see that, do you need to stick them in front of an HD camera and then play it back in slow motion?
Well, actually, interestingly, no. Paul Ekman's designed a training program where you can, within about a half hour or an hour, for example, you can detect micro expressions pretty darn well. And obviously it helps having an HD camera on you and being able to play it back frame by frame, but you can detect these things according to his research just on the fly, but you really have to practice.
Gotta jump in here. Matthew Hertenstein is my guest. His book is called The Tell, The Little Clues That Reveal Big Truths About Who We Are.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Matthew Hertenstein, Associate Professor of Psychology at DePaul University and author of The Tell, The Little Clues That Reveal Big Truths About Who We Are. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. Matt, what can we learn by studying the so-called truth wizards, that small percentage of the population that is quite good at figuring out who's lying?
Yeah, so there is like a small group of people that researchers have studied. And sure enough, they have these very, you know, sort of standardized tests for figuring out who they are. And it turns out that there's only about 50 truth wizards that they've identified as people who are exceptionally gifted at perceiving whether somebody is truthful or lying. And in the book, I talk about one of these women, and she has a website. She calls herself Eyes for Lies. And on the website, she looks at sort of everyday things in the news, whether it's, you know, did person X cheat on her husband or her, his wife or whatnot, to all the way to like court cases and whatnot. And she keeps a record and she makes predictions based on the evidence. And then when the finding comes out that's verifiable or not, in some cases anyways, then she can see whether she's right or wrong. And in the vast majority of time, she's correct. And she took this test that helped identify her as a truth wizard. And she always knew she had it, something special, and she was unique in some ways. And when she found out, she tells me the story, and I relay this in the book. She reacted to the news, and I write this in the book. I'm reading a little portion of it. I quote her and saying, "When I got the test results, I actually bawled my eyes out. My reaction surprised even me. For years and years, I had friends who couldn't see what I saw." And so these people tell us and teach us sort of the clues that they clue into to infer deceit. And sure enough, it maps onto the same ones that the researchers have identified as well.
We have an email here from the very sincere Paul in Terrell, who asks, do successful con men, and I suppose con women, learn to fake their tells? As in the joke, once you can fake sincerity, you've got it made.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, scientists, you know, who study this, unfortunately, we don't get professional con men in there, and so it's hard to tell for sure in terms of the science. But my suspicion, strong suspicion, is yeah, these people are probably masters at their nonverbal communication and what they show and what they decide not to show and faking people out, because they're living relies on it in some ways, and some people are just probably naturally gifted at this. The same thing for lying and telling lies. Most of us are pretty bad liars, but some people are particularly gifted at it.
Okay, if God forbid somebody had to hire a CEO for a major corporation and they couldn't look at a resume, they could only look at photographs, what should they look for?
Interesting. Well, they've done work where they've actually done exactly that. And for male CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, if you have people assess, you know, how smart they look, that doesn't predict anything about the success of the company. If you have people look at how handsome the men are, for example, that doesn't predict anything. But if you ask people to assess how powerful their faces are, you know, how dominant, mature, and powerful those faces are, that surprisingly, at least to me, predicts the profits of their Fortune 500 companies that they run. So researchers have shown this in men. And then when they look at women, you don't want to necessarily look at power. You actually want to look at something that the researchers call competence. So if you have people rate how competent the women look in their photos, the women who appear more competent actually have more run more successful companies. So, you know, beyond anything else, you can make these predictions based on the face. And it's pretty shocking findings, in fact.
And what's all this about? A 3-minute conversation can give somebody a sense of how intelligent we may be.
Yeah, so it turns out that that's one of those things that we're actually naturally gifted at, so to speak. And whether we learn it or over a lifetime or we're biologically predisposed, I don't know. But we're all pretty good at it, and it's this. If you meet somebody and you're talking to them within 3 minutes, you're going to make an assessment about their intelligence. You know, is this person bright? Do they have the cognitive chops to do the job, and so on? And I'm not advocating that we should do this. I'm saying that we have the capacity to, right? And it turns out that our predictions about that actually do map onto reality. So researchers have had people do this exact thing. And then they'll have those people that were judged, you know, take an IQ test or look at their SAT scores and whatnot. And people's assessments, just based on 3 minutes of interaction, do map onto their scores on those IQ tests, their scores on the SATs, and these kind of outcomes. And what they're looking at is the eyes is one thing. So the more directly that people look at you in at your eyes, on average, those people are going to have somewhat higher IQs. And then people who talk clearly, quickly, and loudly, although not too loudly, of course, actually have higher IQs and do have higher SAT scores and whatnot. And so these are things that people pick up on. They might not even realize they're picking up on those specific cues, but those things do predict the intelligence of people, again, on average.
And is that culturally dependent? I'm thinking of places in the world where it's considered quite rude to look someone for a sustained period of time in the eye unless you know them quite well.
Yeah, I'm really glad you said that. Yeah, most of these studies that, not all, but most of the studies, those studies and some of the most of the other studies I've been talking about have been focused on the U.S. And so that's I certainly wouldn't make a claim that that's universally true, but amongst the U.S. And Canadian samples that have been studied, that does seem to bear out.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Jeffrey on the line in Fort Worth. Hello, Jeffrey.
Hello.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
I was wondering if there's been any research on impulsivity in the individuals that you research for the their face width and height. And I was thinking that maybe if they're naturally more impulsive, they might eat more food and put on more weight. And maybe this is why you don't see the correlation in women to their likelihood to skew the numbers, because all women are going to be more naturally inclined to put on more body fat than a male.
Yeah, that's a good question. To my knowledge, nobody's really looked at impulsivity. That doesn't mean that there isn't a connection. It may be just that researchers haven't shined their light on that topic yet. But I will say that men with wider faces perceive themselves to be more powerful. And that powerfulness, that perception of power, researchers think might explain some of their aggressive tendencies and whatnot. So, yeah, I can't speak to impulsivity, but I can speak to power a little bit.
So of all the things in the book, Matt, that one sort of, it made me uncomfortable because it made me think about the now discredited sort of pseudoscience called phrenology. Do you remember that, where people would feel for bumps on the head and say,
sure,
this person clearly will be like this or that? I mean, did those findings initially make researchers uncomfortable, and at what point do they have to find the cause before they can really state that this must be true?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of the early work on phrenology obviously didn't turn out to be true when put to empirical test. And I tell the story in my book, a great story about Charles Darwin almost being rejected for the opportunity to go on the HMS Beagle because somebody thought his nose portended sluggishness and laziness. And obviously that could be the furthest thing from the truth, given his productivity and contributions in science. So, yeah, I mean, I think these things early on were not empirically tested rigorously. And now, with different labs doing the similar work, asking questions in slightly different ways, making sure things replicate, making sure things aren't statistical flukes and whatnot, we can be more confident, even though you're right. I mean, some of the facial, it's looking at physical features predicting something about the social aspect of somebody's life or the outside world. And a lot of these findings are exactly that. But we got to remember, too, it shouldn't be too surprising in some ways that evolution has tuned us into some of these things and wired our brains in such a way that helps us detect these things because it's been evolutionarily adaptive over time.
How much of a role does physical appearance play into, perhaps unconsciously play into, our decisions about who to vote for?
Yeah, so this is, I think, one of the more disturbing somewhat findings in the book. And I tell a story about Abraham Lincoln, who received a letter from an 11-year-old girl named Grace Bedell when he was on the running for president. And Grace wrote him and said that she'd like to vote for him, and her brother and dad would like to as well. But her brother and dad really don't think that he looks that strong and manly and tough, and that he should really grow some whiskers, a beard. And Abraham Lincoln wrote back and said, thanks for the advice, but, I got to do what I got to do. And then, sure enough, I think either before or right after he won the presidency, he grew a beard. And he stopped the train in her town on his way to Washington, D.C., to be inducted, and sure enough, picked up Grace Bedell and thanked her for her advice. And I think even as far back then, right, politicians realize the power of the face and the image to get elected. And it turns out that researchers at Princeton University have done these amazing studies where they'll show two faces of candidates, candidate A, candidate B, just a headshot of these faces, and ask subjects to assess them in terms of how competent they looked, how powerful their faces look, how attractive they are, and they find out that the more competent candidate, the one that's chosen to be more competent, wins the race about 75% of the time. Even they've done the studies even before the race has even been done. So in these senatorial elections at the national level, you can predict this. And an even more shocking finding, at least to me, is that kids can do it. If you researchers in Europe asked kids to judge two parliamentary candidates and asked the kids as young as 5 years old, which of these two candidates would you want to sail your ship across the sea? And those kids, whoever they chose, won the race 75% of the time. So we like to think that our choices are rational when we choose the candidates that represent our interests. But at least for a subset of people who are on the fence or don't know too much about politics or whatever, there seems to be a subset of people that may very well be swayed by how a candidate's face appears.
Let's go next on the phone to Christian in Dallas. Hi, Christian. Nice and quick here, Christian. We're running out of time.
Oh, just quick question. Do we look at people's facial structures and really think of whether or not they're good or bad people, or think of them a certain way? I just think about villains in Hollywood, and sometimes I'm walking down the street and the guy may be really nice, but then I think he's just a bad person. Any thoughts?
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think we do. I mean, unfortunately, our mom and dad may have taught us, don't ever judge a book by its cover. And I think there's some wisdom in that. But the fact of the matter is researchers show that we do judge a book by its cover. We do judge people by their looks. And that's why I argue in the book about the importance of predictive humility, because we've really got to be careful with our judgments, and we want to make sure the evidence aligns with our perceptions. But most evidence suggests that we do make these judgments. We do make them very quickly. They happen fast. And in some cases, especially, aggression and lying and that sort of thing, we can make, most of the time at least, a pretty good prediction. So really interesting study is they gave men 60 euros in one study, and then they gave them a choice to give away some of that money or keep it all for themselves. And then they had people look at their photographs of these men to predict whether or not they would give the money away or not. And about 89% of the people who looked at their photographs could predict whether or not they would give the money away. So you could tell who were going to be the skinflints and the generous ones and not know anything about them.
Matthew Hertenstein is Associate Professor of Psychology at DePaul University. His new book is called The Tell, The Little Clues That Reveal Big Truths About Who We Are. Matt, it's been very interesting. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
I appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show anytime via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.